All right. So I'm a little bit allergic to work. How about you? Would you rather be out like having a drink in Vegas than actually doing work and monitoring email? This session is all about how to allow things to happen while you're not even at your desk. And as you saw, as I left, the Bon Jovi site was provisioned. It was provisioned the way I wanted with the right members. And in this session, that's exactly what we're going to be tackling. So welcome to this afternoon session, which is called Automating SharePoint Governance and Management. My name is Dan Holm. I know many of you have been to my sessions previously in this event, so I'll run through the bio really quickly. I'm an MVP. I'm a consultant for mostly large Fortune caliber organizations. I write books and articles, including the Windows, the SharePoint 2010 Training Kit and the Windows Administration Resource Kit. I live in Maui, Hawaii, the few days a month that I'm actually home. But the most important information on this slide is going to be it's smack dab in the middle at the bottom, which is the URL to my SkyDrive for this event. It's tiny.cc Dan Holm SPC 2012. It is case sensitive, and it's the SkyDrive location for all of my presentations here, so you will be able to find the full slide decks as well as the scripts that I'll be sharing with you in this session. And I'll have this URL up at the end of the presentation and at my presentation on Thursday as well. So that's a great place to go to get all of the resources. The way they scrub the slides for these events, they actually get rid of hidden slides, and I often have a lot of documentation in my hidden slides. So in case they do that to me, you'll be better off having gotten the slide decks from my site there. So we're here to talk about automating governance and management. Let's start with a level set and talk about some of the terminology about what we're really dealing with here. I do a full-day workshop on governance for customers, and this is one of the first things we really have to talk about, is what exactly is governance? And if you go way back in time, governance comes from a Greek root word that dealt with steering a ship. That meant with, and then notice it didn't have to do with the destination, nor did it tell you exactly how to steer the ship. It was just about steering the ship. And that's informative in a way, in that you cannot create governance. You cannot steer a ship without being in the water, nor can you create governance without having something to do that needs governing. Governance can't be a project on its own. Governance is a process that evolves and that creates and spawns new processes and new policies. It's an active, dynamic thing. And if you read definitions in the interweb that talk about governance defining people, processes, and policies that deliver a service, that definition is actually okay, but it's too simple. Because what happens is the community starts to talk about governance in many different ways. I've been in rooms where two people use the word governance and they mean entirely different things. And part of it boils down to that word deliver. That word deliver has two meanings. Governance could be about the people, policies, and processes that deliver an existing service. How do you govern your SharePoint environment? What processes do people need to go through to request a team site or to be added to a group? That is certainly one aspect of governance. Another is, and so there's people and process and policy that get you there. The other is, whoops, sorry, that was that slide, is when the word deliver is used in future tense. Governance is used to put people, policies, and processes together to add something new to your environment. Someone comes and says, hey, we have a contract management workload that is worth X amount of money to our organization if we do it right. Can you do it in SharePoint? And governance then allows you to take that business need and translate it into a service. So in that case, governance is talking about the introduction of new elements rather than the management of existing elements. And so in all reality, governance is all of these things. Governance is part change operation, how you introduce new things. It's part, change management. It's part operations management, how do you keep existing services operating smoothly, updated, patched, configured, administered, et cetera. And it's all about how you take a business need and translate it into a deliverable service. Because as IT, where we need to be as organizations is taking in business requests and turning around and giving them something that solves the problem. Everything else between those two endpoints, those two service endpoints, is about governance. And it's about how we make it happen. But it really should be transparent to the business customer to a certain extent. They should be able to say, here's what I need, and we turn around and give it to them. And governance both consumes people, policies, and processes from the business. You can't deliver a service without understanding the problem and the process that you're trying to address. And governance also produces people, policy, and processes that manage the operations of the existing service. So governance is all of these things. And if you're interested in more of this discussion of the real details and the individual processes that go into this diagram, catch me after the session, and I'll point you to some resources for that. In this session, though, we're talking about automating governance. And when I use that term, we're really talking about this part of governance, the management and the measurement of your service. How do you actually keep it running? How do you take new requests, such as new requests for new team sites, requests to add users to groups, et cetera, and how do you automate those so that in the process you can also measure more effectively, which then gives you the ability to get insight into your service and modify it to make sure that it scales to meet what the business is asking it to do. So this is the part, the subset of governance that we're talking about in this particular session. And my main message here is, yes, I know governance is a big, big, hairy topic. There's a lot of things about governance. And so here we're narrowing it down to these two elements. And on Thursday, we'll be talking about the definition of business needs and the design of an architecture that delivers those business needs. So we'll be looking at the change management side for those two elements of governance on Thursday. So that's governance. What is management exactly? Well, management is all about ensuring that your service does what it needs to do, and it starts with you having to understand what the service needs to do. Policy-based management, specifically, starts with identifying a policy, and that's going to come from the business identifying a need, and then you deciding what kind of information is being used in that workload, and then people are going to have to identify and interpret the policies related to that information. So just as an example, if you're going to be doing a recruiting application to support your HR department, your personnel department, you're going to be working with resumes. That's part of your information classification task, is saying that's one of the classes of information we're dealing with. And the people are going to have to identify what policies affect resumes in your organization, in your vertical, in your country that you live in. And you might, for example, discover that you need to retain resumes for 7 years. Someone's going to have to identify that policy. And then people are going to have to interpret that policy and decide what that really means. Do we have to maintain it in the active service, or can we have it archived? So people are involved with identifying and interpreting the policy. And then you have to assign responsibility of that policy. Who's going to own it and be responsible and take, you know, ownership of the fact that this is the way things need to be done? And other people are affected by policy. So, for example, IT is going to be affected by having to maintain storage for those resumes. And employees might be affected because they might not have permission to those resumes unless they're in HR. You have to define the process that implements the policy. And last but not least, you have to use technology to support it. And you put all of these pieces together, and you can create policy-based management, where you're identifying a policy, and then you're managing the service to that policy. And the technology can really help you enforce that policy. If you're a visual person like I am, you can think of policy as being the sort of outermost layer that then gets interpreted by people, and people decide what kinds of processes they're going to go through to make that policy work. And the unfortunate thing is that we as human beings are fallible. We make mistakes. And if you've ever had to manage to a specific policy with a team of people, you've probably seen that different people miss steps. If you're talking even about something as simple as a team site, someone adds a user to the wrong group or forgets to add a user to the group when they create the site. People make mistakes. And technology can really help us automate the process and enforce the policy, so that if someone asks for a team site, all of the things that need to be done based on the policy as interpreted by people and defined in process actually do happen. And that's what this is all about today, is really creating a managed set of information, a managed workload, a managed service that integrates all of the policies and processes of your organization. So we're going to look at how we automate processes. And the specific examples we'll be looking at are group management and team site management, but we're going to abstract it to a higher level, and because it really this applies to any kinds of operations management you're dealing with. When you've got a service, you want to understand your operations. You need to document what happens. What does your business ask you for, and what do you turn around and give them, and what are the processes that get you from A to B? So, business is going to ask you for a team site. You're going to turn around and give them a team site with these particular configurations and settings and permissions, and what are the processes that get you from point A to point B. You have to understand that before you can really begin to improve those operations. Then you need to measure those operations. Now, I'm not suggesting that you have to go to some like huge, you know, effort to measure down to the dollar and the minute what operations take, but you can at least and should at least start getting a gut feeling for what are the expensive operations, expensive from a hard cost perspective or from a time perspective. So I'll give you an example. This summer, as many of you know, I worked for NBC at the Olympics in London. And we had an environment where on July 4th, which was the day I arrived. It was a construction site, literally. You had to wear a hard hat to go down the hall. 3 weeks later, we had 2,700 people working on a project that generated $1 billion in revenue. That project lasted for 2 weeks, and it was gone, and by closing ceremonies, walls were being torn down. It's a very compressed enterprise life cycle, from the birth to the death of an enterprise. And because of that, the types of things we all fight with SharePoint every day are compressed into this ridiculous time frame. And I knew that in order to support collaboration across our team environments, we were going to have a number of customizations to the team sites. When someone would want a team site, I would have to go through a bunch of processes to create the perfect team site. And I knew that would take about 15 minutes if I were to click through it myself for every single team that requested a site, which would be way more time than I had to spend during that compressed time frame. So I knew that was an expensive operation. I knew that that was something that if I really wanted to decrease my cost of operations, I needed to automate that. So you can identify the expensive processes and then start automating those. And you can automate them with PowerShell, which is what we're going to be doing today, with free out-of-box tools, and that's what this session is about. Or you can turn to third-party tools that obviously have, you know, the advantages of an off-the-shelf product where it's a little bit more of a known entity. It takes less effort on your part, typically. You have support that you can turn to. And instead of having code that when the developer or the IT pro leaves the organization, the rest of the organization doesn't know how to work with the code, you've still got a company backing it up. So you have several ways of automating processes. And each of them have some kind of cost associated with it, whether it's your time or whether it's the cost of a product plus some time. And one of the little points I want to make on this slide is something I talk about in my governance workshops, which is the two ROIs. We've all heard of ROI, return on investment, how much do you get as a benefit for the cost of a particular effort. That is a good calculation, and any vendor worth their salt will be able to help you calculate their ROI on their tool, and you can calculate the ROI of your own investment in automation. So I knew that if I automated team site provisioning for the Olympics, I would save 15 minutes every single time a site was created, which generally would add up to about 8 or 10 hours of time, which in a 2 week period is a huge amount of time. So you can calculate that out. That's normal ROI. The other ROI that I think is more salient these days is risk of inaction, risk of inadequate action, risk of inefficiency. Those are very real things. And let me give you an example that basically boils down to the fact that if you don't do it right, you are taking risks. What is the probability of a risk actually happening in your organization, and what is the cost if that risk happens? I was talking with someone from a bank today, and they were saying that they had a loan wire operations on SharePoint, and their farm went down, and they suddenly discovered how mission critical it was. There was a big risk that actually actualized itself for them. That is something you need to identify, because today, in this economy, return on investment is only a useful calculation if there is money to spend. And most of us don't have money to spend. And our manager is being measured by keeping us in budget. That's all that matters to our manager. But risk of inaction suddenly frees up money, because someone above your manager has their butt on the line. It might be legal. It might be finance. It might be HR. It might be the owners, the shareholders, the board of directors. Someone does care about risk in your organization. And if your risk of inaction is truly a salient factor, if it matters, those people will respond. And I've seen customers basically say, we can't afford this. And 2 weeks later, after having a discussion with them, they say, oh, you know what? Legal ponied up the money for it. Money frees itself out of legal and finance pretty easily if you start talking about risk. So I'm not talking about selling fear just for the sake of selling fear. I'm not. But if you are calculating it effectively and you're being honest and real, it is a very important factor that in this economy tends to move projects forward faster than standard ROI. Just saying. So why do we automate? This is a question that you all probably answered in your own head before coming here. We automate because it increases efficiency. Flip that around. That's reducing costs, reducing administrative effort, and very importantly, liberating administrative effort. When I've gone through ROI, return on investment calculations with organizations, one of the soft benefits that has to be calculated is what happens when you take your expensive administrative team who is currently clicking through the UI, spending 15 minutes to create a team site, and instead you give them 15 minutes to identify and solve new problems. That is a real benefit to an organization, because we're all talented people, and yet we're being locked to our machines, into the GUI and into the PowerShell console, being code monkeys, basically. Most of us would probably feel more satisfied with our jobs if we were really solving new problems. And that is a benefit in a lot of different ways. And when you calculate that out, that can be really quite salient. Another reason we automate is to increase consistency. Obviously, if we have a script, for example, that does something, it means that every time it's done the same way. That reduces human error. A good story I have here is I was working with General Electric in 2000 as we deployed their Active Directory forest. I literally was sitting with their two top admins, and we were creating their forest and their OUs. And we had this process defined about what you did for each OU. And it became clear within half an hour that the three of us who were each generating OUs for different parts of General Electric were making mistakes along the way that would come back and haunt us later. There were just too many steps, too many things to think about, too many clicks, and all three of us were making mistakes. So by automating, you increase consistency, which by itself is a major factor towards increasing security, which, flip it into a risk story, reduces your exposure, reduces your risk exposure. And last but not least, increasing manageability. In the long run, you need to understand the service you're delivering. You need to be able to have insight into it. You need to be able to decrease chaos so that your service can be flexible and scalable and continue to deliver business value. So these are all reasons we automate. And so with that, let's start breaking down how we automate a process using free out-of-box tools in SharePoint, such as what you saw me do when I left the stage during the break. A process has some pretty clear elements, the first of which is the request. The request is what the business gives you, and we'll start with an example of, let's say, adding a user to a group. So there's a request. There's going to be some data points that you need to collect as part of that request. What's the username? What's the group name? What site is it in, for example? Then often there's a workflow. There's something that has to happen to approve that request. That's not always the case, but we'll just assume there's some kind of workflow in many requests. And then there's a process of executing that request, of provisioning it. And this is where, if you're just doing process and people and policy, a human being has to sit down and follow a process that was developed based on the policy, and you cross your fingers and hope you did it right. And all of the policies and logic and procedures that were developed get executed by a human being. Now, so far so good, right? Now, unfortunately, that's probably where most of us in the room stop with most of our processes. And then some point later down the road, something goes wrong and we're asked a question like, what can Dan get to? Or we need to hire someone else who needs exactly Dan's permissions, can you duplicate them? Or who can get to that finance team site? And we suddenly, or how big is it? Whatever the question is, we start getting asked questions and we can't necessarily answer those because we don't have logs that we can drill into to report and to create insight and answers. So we need to have logs. We need to have documentation is the bottom line. And as a consultant, I've yet to be in a business that had a really good document about their service. There usually starts off to be a good document as part of the project management and the development. And then as soon as the service rolls into production, things start getting changed and no one keeps track of them and the service goes off the deep end. We have to have that documentation, and we usually only realize it when there's an insight question or a compliance issue that makes us go, oh yeah, we can't answer that question, or at least not very easily. It's going to cost a lot of time and effort and tools to get the answer to those questions. So there's a big gap there in not only ensuring that the policies are followed, and one of those policies should be documenting, and because of that gap, insight and compliance starts to be a problem. So we're now going to automate this framework with SharePoint and try and solve those problems and fill in the gaps. So first, on the request. We need to have a form where we can submit data. What would be a good place for that? A SharePoint list, obviously. SharePoint's meant for collecting that kind of information. Then what about the workflow? Well, yeah, hey, SharePoint can do that too. SharePoint designer workflows, tools like Nintex or K2 or other vendors that do workflow, we can take care of that piece as well. What about the provisioning step? How about PowerShell? Especially with SharePoint 2013, and PowerShell's just gotten that much better. But even with 2010, PowerShell can do a lot of automation and provisioning for us. And if we are writing a script, then we can ensure that one of the things the script does is dump what it does to a log at whatever level of detail we need. Even if it's just a raw log that we have to go and parse later, at least we have a track of what we did. And then, assuming we're logging effectively, maybe even logging back to SharePoint, we might be able to use standard SharePoint BI tools or even Excel to get that data back in, twist it around into the kind of reports we need. So those are the obvious pieces. The piece that's still missing, though, is how do we enforce that people use our tool and that they don't just go to a site and add a user to a group manually and not follow our processes. And one other thing I'll mention is on the whole idea of data collection and logging. When it comes to auditing, when many of us are looking at compliance issues like SOX and all the others, one of the things that happens quite regularly is that when people in your organization interpret that policy, the policy doesn't tell you how to do it, it just says what has to be done. So people interpret that, and often one of the things that people interpret it to say is, you know, yes, we can go into our logs and we can see who added users to groups or what sites are there. But there's always one very important question that's missing with out-of-box technology, which is why? The business question of why was that user added to a group, who approved it, those kinds of things are always missing from logs because that stuff isn't done with out-of-box. And if we're going to have an automated process that uses a SharePoint list and a script to actually do what we want based on the information in that list that will then log and provide insight for us, how do we ensure that our administrators don't just go into the UI and add the user to the group directly? This is a key element. This is the missing gap, which is the concept of proxy. A proxy is a middleman that actually does the execution of the task. And that proxy, is, in this case, will have the credentials it requires to do whatever it is we're asking it to do. And we will take that ability away from our help desk, our administrators, our business owners. So now, whoever we want to make a request can make a request, but they have to do it in our tool because they no longer have the permissions to do it directly in the UI. By using our tool, we enforce our policies, processes, and logic, including documentation. And so all we need is that element of a proxy that runs at high enough credentials to do whatever it is we're asking it to do. And that then isolates the request side of the story from the execution, the provisioning, and the logging side of the story. So those are the pieces we're going to use. And to get the proxy piece in place, we're going to use a scheduled task. So let's see an example here. Let's jump into the UI and look at, we'll repeat the demos I did right before the session, and then we'll look into how they work. Whoops. And so the way we're going to approach this is we're going to treat this like an onion. We're going to look at a very high level to see all the how pieces fit together. We're going to see the forest, and then we're going to go in and look at the trees. And just to make sure everyone's comfortable with this, you're going to get all of the scripts that I use to do this, so you can tear into it, customize it, do whatever the heck you want with it. It'll be in my SkyDrive. So let's close the Bon Jovi site for a second here, and let's go back to our finance team site. So this is our finance team site, and these are the members of the members group. Whoops. So go into site settings, site permissions, into the members group. Linda was the one I added right before the session. So now we're going to go to, and remember, we're just doing the high pieces here. Don't worry about how it's done yet. We're going to go to a SharePoint site. This is the request, and we're going to fill the request. I'm going to say we need to add Sanjay S. to the finance members group. So the team site is finance, the group is members, the person is Sanjay. Oh, by the way, if you haven't played with 2013 yet, look at the cool type ahead in the people picker now. That, you know, the old 2010 people picker was so not usable. Now it is. It's great. Reason for change, new employee. And notice this is where we are enforcing some policies. It's a required field. You cannot click save without actually filling that in. Notice the required star is no longer red, which is unfortunate, but that's all right. The next thing that would happen would be a workflow. Now, I'm going to skip the workflow part just because we only have an hour and 15 minutes, but we all understand you can open up SharePoint Designer, you can create a workflow, and someone can approve it. So we'll go ahead and just say, for the sake of argument, that Dan approved this using whatever SharePoint Designer workflow, and we change the status to approved. Now we click save. Now let's see, it is 20 till. This particular, my SLA to my business is that when a user needs to be added to a site, they will be added within 1 minute of being approved. Now that's a really high SLA because we're in a room for an hour and 15 minutes, and we don't have that much time. You might have a 15-minute SLA or whatever the case is, but we've got a one-minute SLA. So as I'm standing here stalling, we've already taken 20 seconds. Let's see if by any chance, voila, he's already in there. So that is the task has been provisioned. It's been logged. And now I can go and I can, oh, and by the way, if we go back to this request site itself and refresh this as well, you'll notice we can see who approved it. the fact that it was completed and the time it was completed. So we now have the ability, even with a SharePoint list, to log our actions. And then, of course, we can export it to Excel and run pivot tables and say, what does Sanjay have access to? That's going to be an easy question to answer now because we've logged it. And as long as the user who makes the requests cannot actually go into the UI and work around our system, as long as they don't have permissions themselves to manage group membership, we now can ensure that we have that log and that everything that's been done has been done correctly. So that's one example. Like it? All right, cool. Right on. So let's take a look at now the pieces of how this was put together. Now, this particular provisioning request is actually pretty easy. Adding groups, users to groups is easy. The site, we're going to do site provisioning, which gets much more interesting because you're going to all want to go 15,000 different directions with it. But adding a user to group is pretty easy. So let's look at it. In our framework, the first thing we needed to have was the request. The request had data points, and that we decided, or at least I proposed, a SharePoint list would be good for. So we've got a list. And this particular list, let's go into its settings, has a couple of columns. Let me zoom in so you can see these. Has a couple of columns. The title column I renamed to a description, and then you have to pick a site, which is a drop-down list, the group within the site, which is another drop-down list, the people picker for the user, the required change of the required field of the reason for change, and then who approved it, the request status, which goes, in my case, from requested to approved to either completed or error, if there was a problem, and then some logging fields, which are what happened, what version of the script made the change, and when was that request fulfilled. I also have one other cool little feature in my scripts, which is the ability to schedule the change. I didn't point that out when I made the request initially, but when I do create a request, I have the ability to schedule the change. So if I know this employee is going to be hired on Monday, I can schedule that change to be made Sunday night, for example. The script will honor that. So this is the list. Now, behind the scenes, there's and then the workflow, as I mentioned, we're just going to sort of skip. That's just SharePoint Designer stuff that would do whatever you need to do to set that status field to approved. Then we have the script that does the provisioning. So the script that does the provisioning is a PowerShell script. If you're not a PowerShell person, don't worry too much because we will. You'll find that these scripts are well commented. Everything that's in green is a comment, so you can read this stuff, and you'll probably be able to figure it out on your own. In this script, there are a few hardwired variables. I'll zoom in so you can see these here, including the domain name, the site, and the list name where the requests are being made, and then some other information, and everything's highly, highly commented. And the bottom line is what this script is going to do, and let me scroll down so you can see where it does it. What the script is going to do is it is going to connect to the website, to the list, and it is going to get a list of items. It's going to get the whole list. And then for each item in the list, it is going to, super zoom. For each item in the list, it is going to look at whether it is both approved and if it has a scheduled date that we're now after that scheduled date. So those are the two criteria that this script decides, and should I actually process this request? And it just loops through each request and checks, is it approved and not yet finished, and is it time to actually run? So it's doing a loop. And then within the loop, it does all the logic it needs to do about adding group membership. And so, for example, adding group membership basically boils down to getting the user's logon ID, which comes from the people picker, going into the appropriate website and ensuring the user already belongs, because you can't add a user to a group unless the user has been added to the website. So this one method allows you to both grab onto a user if they exist, and if they don't exist, it adds the user to the site. So it's a really nice little method. Once we've got that user, which is here, we've grabbed onto it, we then take the group, which it latches onto earlier in the script, and add the user to it. It's that simple. Everything else is a matter of getting those variables in place, consuming them from the list, and perhaps performing some logic to decide, performing any logic that needs to be done. So that is the heart of the script right there, grabbing onto the user, ensuring they're in the website, adding them to the group. Now, the way the script makes the association between the list and what it needs is, again, up here at the top. Let me show you. The script is going to use variables like member field. So that's what it calls the people picker. Right here in the script, you are telling the script that in my list, I've used the name person for that column. So if we switch back to the actual website, you'll notice it's called person. So I could change this to user or employee or anything else I wanted to. All I would need to do is tell the script in this one place that the label in the list is X, and then the script will behave with it correctly. So basically, you'll be able to take these scripts and change the things that are at the top to be appropriate for your organization, where the list is, what the fields are that you've called things, and then it will do what it needs to do. And of course, you can also drill into the scripts and add all kinds of additional fancy logic and all that kind of stuff. So this is the script itself is basically adding users to groups, wrapped inside of a connect to the list and loop through every item in the list and do whatever needs to be done. So far, so good? All right. The other key piece of this, I forgot to mention the logging. One of the things I mentioned is, it's important to be logging things. So in this script, there are some logging functions. This is a simple script, so there's not too much to log. But it is going to log, let's see, where did I put it? Let's see, there's the status, the date. Some of you might see it, and I don't. I'm looking for the date, actually. Request fulfilled date. Oh, there it is. Sorry, I see it now. All right. So this is where the logging is happening. So for example, we are logging whether the script succeeded or failed. So it changes the status to either completed or error. And either way, it won't run the task again. It will assume if there was an error this first time, it just will skip it until a human being has figured out what's going wrong. It also logs the date that the script actually got executed. And the version of the script that created the change. And the version of the script is actually defined right up at the top. It just is a string label. And I like to keep track of that because it's basically a way of doing change management. So if later I decided some of my logic has not quite been right or there's a new policy, I can go identify which actions were taken under the old way of doing things, and I can tweak those. So having that script version and the completed date both help you do that kind of change management. And last but not least, PowerShell has the ability of dumping what's called a transcript, which is basically everything you would normally see going out to the command shell, to the PowerShell window, can be dumped and captured. So it does a raw capture of what the script would output, and it stuffs that into the log field in the list. So if we jump back to the list and we look at the actual request for Sanjay here, notice there's that transcript. So in a worst-case scenario, I've got sort of a raw log of whatever I wrote the script to dump that I can go back and parse later. So the script is ensuring the logging is happening. It's ensuring the process is being followed. That missing element was the proxy. So the proxy element of all of this in this framework is simply a scheduled task. And again, we're going to go into all these elements in more detail, but let's take a look at this one. I've got a scheduled task running on Windows. So this is a Windows scheduled task, not a timer job. The scheduled task is scheduled to run every 1 minute. Let's actually dive into that. Scheduled to run every 1 minute. What it does when it runs is it runs PowerShell.exe, followed by the path to the script. And it runs under the context, the security context of this account. Whether that account is logged on or not, and it runs as administrator in case this needs to do things like creating web apps or anything like that. So what I've got here is effectively a script that runs like a service. Instead of being a true Windows service, it's a scheduled task running with certain credentials, and it has the same security isolation benefits of a service, and it's something that you can do with an IT pro skill set as opposed to needing Visual Studio to create a Windows service. So those are the elements that put together make it all work. I've got a script running with the right credentials on a certain time frame. The script itself enforces my policies, procedures, including the concept of documenting and making sure that I then can go and have insight into what changes have been made in my environment. And this is just one example. Actually, we're doing okay on time. Any questions on this example before we go to site provisioning? Oh, good question. That's an important piece. Where's the script running from? You do have to make sure that your script has access to whatever functionality it needs. So in this case, the script is doing a lot with SharePoint. So it needs access to the SharePoint snap-ins for PowerShell. That can be done two ways. The way I've chosen to do it is actually to run it on the SharePoint server itself, on one of my servers. It doesn't matter which server, but it's running on the C drive under admin, group management. That's my actual script. And I chose to do that because your other option is to use PowerShell remoting. And PowerShell remoting means you run a PowerShell console on any machine, you connect to your SharePoint environment, and you're basically, it's almost like remote desktop for PowerShell, you're consuming the capabilities of that remote machine in that session. But when you write a PowerShell script for remoting, the syntax becomes a lot more complicated, and there's certain things that I found I just can't do, certainly not easily. So I've chosen to run it on one of my servers, and in the case of a multi-server farm, you might choose to put it on one of your app servers or on your central administration server. It almost doesn't matter. Yeah, his question is, would this be suitable for Office 365? Actually, yes, you can do this in Office 365, particularly with 2013 and its new PowerShell capabilities. What you can do is obviously significantly limited because it's Office 365. You can't create a site collection, for example. But you can still have the concept of running a PowerShell script as a scheduled task with elevated credentials that have the right permissions in your Office 365 environment, connecting to the Office 365 session, making your changes. You might find that you have to do more with the client-side object model than you would on-prem, but the same basic concepts work. And Office 365 does open up Office 365 2013 does open up a lot of additional capabilities for automation. There was another question. Yes. Good question. Okay, so his question is about the basic proxy element here, which is the scheduled task running it with the credentials it needs to actually make the change. That means that a user can't go and add a user to a group, for example. They have to go through my tool. Now, the hold on, there was something I was going to say here. So the concept is the users are not going to get the permissions. Oh, I know what it was. So the only remaining question is who can make a request, right? I can control that by simply setting permissions on the list. I can say my help desk is allowed to make requests on the SharePoint list, but normal users can't. Or business users from this department can make a request on this list. So I can use standard SharePoint security to define who gets to put the request in. I can use workflows to control who can approve. And as long as the request is in the list marked as approved, and the time has passed, that's all that the script cares about. So everything before that is just SharePoint security. Yeah, so the idea here is you're using this process you're using this framework to automate a process that you don't want to run wild. If you're okay with something running wild, there's no need to do this, right? But if you have concerns about enforcing policies and procedures, about getting insight into what's actually happening in your environment, including answers to questions like why, then you can't let users do those things because we all know users won't do it right. Even administrators don't do it right. So you need to match this capability to business workloads that, and so as a simple example, I have clients who, for regulatory reasons, they must be able to answer the reason. They must be able to answer the basic questions of who was added to which group, when, and why. That last question, from a compliance perspective, cannot be answered if you let people go straight into the out-of-box tools because there is not a field in the form when you add a user to a group in SharePoint that says, why are you doing this? You have to do that yourself. So you have to match you have to understand what your business process is trying to achieve to decide whether you even need to automate it, right? Other questions? Yes. His question is, can this be done as a timer job or as a Windows service? Absolutely. And we'll talk later on about sort of elevating this to the next level. So hold on to that question. Yep. Yes. Yeah. I don't have examples, but I can explain it. So what his question is in this case, I've got sort of one central group request site that people can go and make a request sort of throughout the environment. That scope is very large. I might very well have a group request list on the finance site and a group request list on the HR site. And my script could actually consume each of those and iterate through each of them. So you can scope this however you want. It's the exact same framework. It's just a matter of where's the request list and is your script connecting to it and consuming the information from it. So absolutely, you can scope this big, small, whatever makes sense for your business process. All right, let's turn our attention to the site provisioning example, because this gets a lot more interesting, a lot more complicated, and also a lot more valuable, I think, for many of us. So the site request, it uses the same basic idea of we have a business need, which is to rapidly request and get team sites for collaboration. We've gone through the governance process and we've identified certain policies related to team sites. For example, we need to know whether that team site is going to have confidential, export-controlled, privacy-related information, what kind of information is on the team site, because that's going to affect what web app we put it in, what farm we put it in, what controls we put it around, how much backup and restore we do. So we need users to classify information when they create a team site. We might need to know when the team is going to be finished so we can delete and archive the site. We might want to be capturing that information. We might want to ensure that when the business owner asks for a team site, that business owner has the ability of populating the groups from the very beginning and saying who's in those groups. We might have things that say the document library in a team site has to have checkout enabled and versioning limits set. Whatever those processes and whatever those policies are that drove us to have to manage certain processes, we want to automate all of those. So in this particular example, let me show you what I've got and what I'll give you. This is a team site request where we create a site for a team, let's say it's sales, and we pick, in this case, whether we're doing some classification. Is it a department, team, or project? Now in my case, all that's really doing is determining what managed path it goes under. Whoops, actually I want it to be department. It might make you choose a farm or a web app or information management controls. In this case, it's just going to do the URL. We can put in the site title and description, which appear at the top of every site. So let's just call this sales team site. And we can say the description is collaboration for the sales organization. We put in a business contact. This is another piece of key information that's missing for most organizations, is who's responsible for this, not from a technical site collection administrator perspective, but from a business perspective. Who's the business owner? Now, I might have created this list where this pre-populates as the requestor. If I'm requesting the site, I'm the business contact. In this case, I'm just gonna populate it with a people picker. And let's say for sales, we're gonna have maybe some confidential information, but no records, no PII, privacy, and no export-controlled information. And again, this is all just so that we can then make informed decisions about how and where we create the site and what policies we apply based on the user configuring specifying what the site contains. What's the business criticality of the site? This is just an example here, but the idea is that I have customers that do want to identify levels of business criticality, because if something is highly business critical, they actually put it in a farm that has offsite disaster recovery, it has different backup and restore policies. There's all kinds of logic you might use based on definitions of criticality. Then I'm going to let the business owner say who the administrator should be. In this case, there's no one who technically needs to be an administrator, so we'll just skip that. Who's the owner of the site? That's one of our sales VPs. The members include Linda Mitchell, Scott Mitchell, and Tony Krinan. Now notice in this case I didn't do people pickers. It's only because of lack of time to create the demo, so I just did a comment delimited text. But you could do people pickers. The base name for groups. When you create a site called sales, what are the default groups going to be called? Sales owners, sales visitors, sales members. That might be okay for you, but in a lot of my customers, they want to have a little bit more control over those base group names, so I might want to call it sales team site, so that it's differential from the sales project site or the sales department site or whatever else it might be. So I'm going to actually call this sales team, and that then will create sales team owners, sales team site, owners, visitors, and members. Again, we would normally start this as requested. I'm going to skip the workflow and just go ahead and approve it. And I could schedule this. I'll skip that step just because we need to get through this. And click Save. So we now have the request. Let's view the request here. Make sure I did everything right. The approval is the main thing. Okay, I did approve it. Now let's go look at the scheduled task. So the scheduled task for this is going to run every 5 minutes. So my SLA for this particular service to my business is after a request has been approved, within 5 minutes that site will be created. That's exactly what I did at the Olympics, in fact, which meant I didn't even have to be at my desk and someone could actually get their team site, which was a very good thing. So let's refresh this and see when the last time it ran. The last runtime was 3:58. Okay, I don't want to wait that long, so I'm going to manually run it. And we'll let it run, and we'll watch that status. Now, creating a site collection takes time, just like it does in the UI. PowerShell takes the same amount of time. It has to do all the magic, so it's going to take a minute or so to do that. While it's doing that, we'll just let it finish. While it's doing that, I'll point out a few features of this script. The way these scripts work is they create what's called temp transcript, which is the processing of the specific request. And this is what then gets loaded in back into the SharePoint site as the log. So this is the transcript of the individual action. So let's see if this is doing it. Yep, it's creating sales. I see sales all over the place here. It also creates a log for the script itself. Remember, the script is connecting to the website. It's iterating through the list. And so it creates a log just so that if nothing's happened at all, you can go into this log and see why the entire script failed. So the script has its own log that's stored in the same directory as the script. Each action it performs creates a temporary log that then gets put back into SharePoint. So that's the logging model that I've got in these scripts. So we can see this is processing 8 requests. There's 8 requests in the list. That doesn't mean it's going to execute all the requests. That's just telling us how many were currently in the list. And let's see. All right, the task is finished. So I cross my fingers and pray to the gods of live demos. And we go to http://teams.contoso.com/departments/sales. And yeah, it's there. We go into site settings. Thank you. Yes, please. We go into site settings and we see that the sales team site members group has my name, and voila, it has the right members in it. What else is done by this script? In this case, as we'll see in the script, I've got some other things it's doing along the way, including turning on and off some features. So for example, let's go into site features, which has now been, everything's been moved around. Well, site collection features, we'll start there. Site collection features, I've turned on the publishing infrastructure. Notice it's active now. Even though it's a team site, I've turned on publishing. And then at the site level, site features, and this is something I did at the Olympics, so I just kept it in here as an example. Where is it? Publishing is turned on at the site level as well, but there was one other thing that I'm actually not seeing here. So we'll skip that one. And let me see what else it's doing, if I can remember. Well, we'll dig into the script and see what else it's doing. And in the case of my work at the Olympics, I actually did a lot of tweaking of the UI, pulling out default lists, adding new lists and template and libraries and stuff like that. And those kinds of changes you could do with a site template or a site definition if you had a developer create a good site definition. And you could certainly deploy a custom template as part of this. I chose to do it all with PowerShell, first of all, because I was curious to see how much I could do with PowerShell. And also because in the end, there's always going to be a role for something like PowerShell, because you're going to want to add users to groups. You're going to want to make instance-specific changes to the template. So a template can give you default lists and libraries and functionality and branding and whatever else your solution gives you. But you're always going to have some things you need to do in PowerShell, so I just chose to load it all into PowerShell. Now let's dig into this back to our request list. And if we go back to the request list and refresh this request, we see, sure enough, it completed. This is the time it completed. This is the log of what happened. I don't see any errors. It logs the URL of the resulting site collection. And just because I wanted this, it logs the resulting site collection administrators. Now, you might remember when I made the request, I didn't ask for any site collection administrators. But my company policy specifies that certain people need to be site collection administrators, and the script enforces that. So what the script does is take the company policy list plus whatever is requested in the request, merges them together, and then it logs the resultant set of administrators just for informational and insight purposes back to the list. So if we go to site collection administrators, we'll see there are, in fact, 4 site collection administrators. SP admin, which is my farm administrator group. the group SP admins. And people think you can't put a group in Site Collection Administrators. You can. You can't do it in Central Admin because that's actually called the owner, even though its label says the administrator. In your Site Collection itself, here, you can add a group, which then means you can just put people in the group in Active Directory. And then Sanjay, who is our CIO, Chief Security Officer, is in there based on corporate policy. So let's look at this script and see what this script is doing. So I go into the script, open it. Whoops, let's do the IDE or the ISE. By the way, the new PowerShell 3.0 integrated scripting environment is awesome. IntelliSense, hello. I actually found the demo script that I've been using for the last 9 months doing this different, you know, I changed this talk every time, but the evolved script was carrying with it a variable that wasn't defined correctly, and I didn't even know it until last night because the new ISE had it little red squiggly underline on it. I was like, oh, cool, love this. All right, let's take a look at the script. So at the top of the script, it's defining the name of the script and the version, and this is, again, just simply so it can be logged into the SharePoint list and I can do my change management. Down here a little bit further, we start defining all those variables again. Your domain name, the location that the website and the list that the script is connecting to. And in this, for this particular script, I'm assuming that all team sites are going to be put into a single web app. You might have logic that consumes information from the list and says if it's a highly critical web app, it goes over here, whatever. I'm just keeping it simple. So it's all being created in a single web app. I am specifying that this web app is a claims-based app because it makes a difference when we have to go look for users later. They've got these new funky prefixes from claims. And then, again, I am specifying which fields in the list, the label is request status, are being assigned to a variable in the script so that the script can keep working with this variable, and if ever I change it in my list, I simply have to modify that. So you can use whatever labels you want. If you are, you know, from another country with a different language, you can do that. So scrolling down a little bit further, again, we continue to attach labels to variables. And for each field, so these are basically the fields in the list that you need to create. For each field, I document in here what that field should be. So in this case, I suggest that you take the default title column of your list and change it. Further down here, you'll see, you'll see that for the request status field, I specify that you want to make sure that it has a value approved because that's what the script is looking for, and if you use a different label, you'll want to modify the script. So each of the fields are defined here. So if you look at the top of the script, this tells you exactly what SharePoint list you need to create. It gives you everything, all the fields that this my version of the script is expecting. So we go down a little bit further, and we start seeing some hardwired logic. I'm starting with the default team site template, for example. Here is the business policy about what accounts must be site collection owners, the primary and secondary. So at this point, my guidance to customers is that the primary and secondary site owners, let me just take a step back. A lot of people don't yet understand the difference between the site owners in central administration, of which there are two, and they must be users, they cannot be groups, and the site collection administrators, which are actually part of the site collection itself, which can be many, 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 and can include groups. They all get full control. The only functional difference is that the two owners get email notifications specifically about quotas and about site expiration and deletion if you're using the out-of-box policies for that. So that's the only functional difference between, and also the way you access them in code is different. But otherwise, they're all full control. So what I'm recommending currently to customers is that when you create a site collection, use your generic administrative account. And for those of you who don't know about this, go watch my video from yesterday on deployment, SP admin, which is not used by a human being unless you have an emergency, but at least it's there as a site collection administrator of all your site collections. And then also your site provisioning your provisioning script account. Because your provisioning script account, that SCR provisioning that you see on the screen, is going to need permissions to get into site collections to do things like add users to groups. If it's not a site collection administrator, it's not going to be able to do that. So when you create your site collections, just proactively make that the owner. And then the SP admin account can have an email address so that any emails go to your entire SharePoint team, and this is a good way to go. And then your real site collection administrators, just put them into the bucket in the site collection itself, your normal human site collection administrators. So these are the primary and secondary owners. Then here is my list of who I want in the actual site collection administrators group, which is our chief security officer and the active directory group of site collection administrators. So that's my help desk, my IT team, for example. And here again, we're connecting to the list, we're looping through, and for each one, we are going to look at, is it approved? And is the date happened yet or not? And based on that, we then dive in. And so here is where it gets really interesting. There's a set of logic that reads the list and says, what is the site we're creating? Sales. What is its title and description? And the script actually has logic that says, if you left the title or description blank, it's going to be the same as the website name. So the properties just sort of cascade down as default values, which makes sense. Then it decides what URL the web app is going to be on based on what type of site it was. Is it a department, team, or project? That determines the managed path. Obviously, the web application needs to have a managed path that support it, or your script would have to create those. And then we get down a little bit further, and we're just consuming the rest of the fields in the list. So this is in the list. We had a field that defined who the owners, members, and visitors should be, the actual users, and we're just assigning those to variables to use later. Continuing down further, we create the site. New SP site, one of the most common PowerShell commandlets of all, and we're just pumping into it the variables that we consumed from the list a little bit earlier for who the primary and secondary owners should be. Once we've created the site, we check to make sure it got created. If it didn't, we're going to bail out, basically, eventually here. But assuming it did get created, we're going to attach to the root web, and we're going to start doing some things. We're going to assign, we do a little cleanup of display names of the primary and secondary site owners because they come out strangely. So that's just some UI cleanup. And then this is where we go in and assign the site collection administrators in the site collection. For each user or group, we make sure that if they're not a site collection administrator already, we make them a site collection administrator, and we log it. After we've done that, this is doing it for all of our policy-based site collection administrators. Next, we do the exact same thing for the requested site collection administrators. We then go and do the same thing for the owners, members, and visitors groups. Before we do the owners, members, and visitors groups, we actually have to erase the old groups and recreate them so that they get the right names correctly. There's some weird things that PowerShell does when it creates those groups, so we recreate them so that we have new groups with the right names. We assign owners, members, and visitors. I also have a feature here just as an example for you. In the site request, you have the ability to specify that you want this site to allow all authenticated users read access. So this would be sort of like, you know, your company benefits site, where HR is going to make modifications, but you want everyone to have read access. That's just a check mark, a yes-no field in the list, and we use that in the script to decide whether we are going to put NT authenticated users into the visitors group as well. Going down further, we enable features, so we enable publishing at both the site and site collection level. The other feature I'm enabling is the open and client feature. This is the one I couldn't find, and I need to figure out why. Maybe it's not in 2013, actually. But I used this in the Olympics, so the piece of code got stuck in here. In the case of the Olympics, we dealt with 2,700 people who had no clue about SharePoint at all, and they certainly didn't understand Office Web Apps. We had zero time to train them. So we decided we're going to pretend like Office Web Apps weren't there, even though they were. So when a user clicked a document in a document library, we wanted it to open in the client. By default in SharePoint 2010, when you click a document in a library, it opens in Office Web Apps. So we enabled the feature that sends it to the client instead. Last but not least, we are good memory citizens, and we dispose of the objects we've been working with. That's a sort of a common coding thing. And then we finish. We've been logging it the whole way with a transcript, which we then get, and we're going to dump into the log field in the list, mark it as completed or error, pop in the date, and the version and the URL of the resulting site, and we are now finished, and we loop back again. So with that now, we've got a good log of all of the sites we've requested. We can go into our list, and we can export that to Excel, and we can find out how many team sites we've got, who is administrators of each site. We can start pivoting the heck out of this information. Or you can get much more sophisticated, and instead of having your script dump it to SharePoint, you might be dumping it into SQL, and running reporting services on it or something along those lines, which takes us back to our slides. So the key pieces here are described on the slide. We have a SharePoint list for requesting and logging, a PowerShell script that does the heavy lifting. It runs as a scheduled task that has the credentials it needs and does the logging along the way. If you want to take this to the next level, you can. You can take each piece of this framework and bump it up a notch. The SharePoint list, maybe you want to be using InfoPath forms instead of standard list forms. Make them prettier, make them have business logic, connect to backend data sources with BCS, go bananas. You want to have a drop-down list of employees, pull that from PeopleSoft if you want to. The workflow, move from SharePoint Designer workflow to third-party workflow tools, get as fancy as you need it to be. And some of the third-party workflow tools actually have things like site provisioning already built into them, by the way. The provisioning piece, instead of a PowerShell script, you might choose to write a .NET app that does it. I really like PowerShell because it's so easy to change. And when I've done this for this kind of thing for really big customers, what we ended up doing was we wrote a .NET app that did certain things, but then it basically called a PowerShell script so that when we were all finished with the project, we could leave. The .NET app would be the same, but the administrators could update the PowerShell part. So we gave them extensibility by calling out to PowerShell for part of the process. So I don't necessarily recommend writing it all as a .NET app unless you're working for a third-party vendor making these things. The proxying, as a question was asked earlier, you could bump into a timer job. You could create a Windows service. There are several different ways you could choose to bump this up a notch as well. The logging, maybe dump it into a SQL database, and instead of using just Excel, use reporting services and SharePoint's out-of-box BI tools. I was with a customer in Switzerland 2 weeks ago that had this exact same basic framework for their monitoring. They had scripted monitoring their entire environment. They had rewritten SCOM in PowerShell, and it was much better than SCOM. They had PowerShell scripts that ran at certain specified intervals that went through and pulled every possible metric they could ever want out of their farm, dumped it into a SQL. They had reporting services, and the reports that they created were beautiful. You could pivot the entire environment any direction you wanted and get every bit of information out. Very, very, very cool. And they've done it all themselves. The last note here is that obviously you've got the ability to turn to third parties as well. And we talked about ROI, both the return on investment and the risk of inaction. You've seen that it's actually pretty easy to do this with the free tools. And I can tell you that as simple as these tools are, SharePoint list, PowerShell script, scheduled task, those from an architectural perspective are all you need for security, compliance, and robustness. There's nothing magical about going all the way to a third-party tool or stopping in between with a timer job. It's just a matter of meeting your business needs for improving operations. The one place third parties really excel and start doing things that you cannot do with PowerShell is when the third party is automating a capability that isn't part of SharePoint in the first place. So I'll give you an example. SharePoint doesn't have granular restore to the document level, right? It only goes down to the list or library, and even that has some serious weaknesses. If I wanted to build a way that a user could go to a site and say, I need this document back, this one document that I just messed up, there would be no way I could do that with PowerShell because SharePoint never backed it up right in the first place. So if a third-party tool can give me granular restore and then either allow me to script it with PowerShell or give me their own tool to automate it, then all of a sudden, I'm getting value that I could never even dream of getting with out-of-box tools in this framework. So, you know, what I encourage you to do is, because I know we're all tight on budgets and stuff, take this framework back and figure out what you can do with it. You can provision sites. You can manage group memberships. I had password resets being done through this at the Olympics because of the business process allowed us to do that. We had all kinds of things that we use this framework for. That will spur the imagination, and it will help your organization see why reducing administrative effort, improving efficiency, and liberating you to actually deliver business value, they'll start seeing that in action. And they'll respond better when you come back and say, now I want to get this third-party tool that starts doing these additional things. They'll say, oh, yeah, after that site provisioning tool, we want you to automate as much as you possibly can because you turn around and do good stuff for us as a business. So with that, I'd like to say mahalo. Thank you. And don't forget to write down that first URL. I will be uploading the scripts and the slides from this presentation for you to Danholm SPC 2012. Please stay in touch. If you start doing some of these things, or if you've done them already, because I know some people in this room have already built these kinds of tools, please share them with me if you're comfortable, because I would love to amplify those to the community and help us all find what we can do to be successful in automating operations in SharePoint. On Thursday, I'm doing a session on the other side of governance, which is how to go from business needs to technical architecture. So it's a technical architecture session on how you ensure your service is scalable and manageable as it changes over time. Hope to see you then. Have a great evening and enjoy Bon Jovi tonight. Thanks.